session number 18089, Reel 2.
You mentioned the detachment to Cyprus, but I'm interested going back to airman recognition. How were the ground crews organised? You had a crew chief, presumably.
No, the crew chief, I think... Well, I don't know.
Was that an American?
The crew chief was initially an American term. Mm. Certainly, that term was in use in the V-Force and was in use when I arrived there. But I remember it was very much chiefy. The gentleman who ran the line, as it was called, was a flight sergeant. And I seem to recall Warrant Officer Law was promoted to Warrant Officer Law and had been Flight Sergeant Law in the time that I was on the squadron. But he was known affectionately as Chiefy. It was a term of respect and a touch of familiarity. But that was that. And he, of course, had an all-encompassing responsibility across all of the trades. Unlike today, I suppose, there weren't too many trades. You had your airframe fitters, riggers, you had your engine fitters and riggers, and I suppose you had your armourers with maybe an instrument mechanic or so thrown in. And that really was about the range.
Avionics? Really
didn't have avionics at that stage. Mm. Radio, and that would become about instruments, radio and instruments, I suspect. The only, oh dear, somebody's going to challenge this one day perhaps, the only really high-tech bit of kit would have been the gyro gun sight and the associated camera which perched on top of it. We had no other electronics, avionics, we had no ECM, nothing of that sort in that day, nothing at all. Mm. No.
So you detached to Cyprus for exercises, did you?
No, we detached to Cyprus. This is the major exercise, as I recall, towards the end of 1958, because of the Iraq situation then. I can't recall the detail of the political situation, but I believe the king or the prime minister had been assassinated. The squadrons that were then resident in that part of the world moved on to Jordan, maybe, and a number of Hunter squadrons from the UK moved out to Cyprus, to Nicosia in particular. And I have a photograph in my album of something like 60 Hunters on the ground at Nicosia. I'm not quite sure how we might have been employed. I do know that that was an introduction to what was called Rat and Terrier. That was my first introduction to low-level interception, because we had been predominantly high-level in this country. We did our conversion on that detachment to low-level interception. Beyond that, I don't recall a great deal.
What aircraft did the Iraqis have then that might have constituted a threat?
I don't know, except I can only... I'm not sure they didn't have Hunters as well. I do recall in advanced flying training we had on the FTS at Middle St. George some Iraqis and some Syrians and some Indonesians. I don't recall them coming through our OCUs with us. They returned home for their operational conversion. I'm afraid I'm hazy on what they might have been flying. As I say, I have very little perception of the political scene at that time. Again, I suspect I was somewhat overawed by the whole of experience. I was certainly intimidated by the very transit flight to Cyprus. Even now, some 2 years on the squadron, I had never spent a long time flying over water with a single engine. Our routing was through Orange in the south of France and then to overnight in Malta. And I do remember approaching that stage from southern France to Malta with some trepidation in case I couldn't find Malta at the other end, given the limited nav aids that we had
at
the time.
Then?
Yes, we were in formation, and I was deputy leader. By that stage, I was number three of a formation of four. I had progressed some while. And there's an interesting story. We arrived at Nicosia. Their runway were flying direction was 3-2, I remember. And we were told that the first few hundred yards of the runway was sterile. And they had marked the sterility by stringing a wire across or to mark the false threshold, and we were told, not surprisingly, to land beyond the wire. Well, numbers 1 and 2 landed beyond the wire, as did I. My wingman, whose name again I won't mention, but I know him well, he's still alive, he flew into the wire, which was barbed, thereby puncturing a tire or bursting a tire and causing a wee bit of embarrassment on landing. But it was great fun to be as part of that large organisation on the ground. We did a fair amount of convoy escort work as well. There were a number of radar stations set up, and there was one in the southeast corner of the island on one of the capes, Cape Greco perhaps. And we had a detachment based in Famagusta, which used to move out of Famagusta to operate this radar site. It moved out at dawn, operated the radar site all day, and then moved back at dusk into the secure compound, I suppose, at Famagusta. They had frequently been ambushed whilst en route by snipers and this sort of thing. And
the Aoka,
that's right, yeah. Yes, exactly. The Aoka campaign was running. And we were employed to patrol this convoy. We were required to fly at the rate of convoy progression. Now, the convoy was perhaps proceeding at 30 miles an hour. It was somewhat difficult on the Hunter, so we did a series of looping-type manoeuvres to keep back with this. And we were engaged on one day. We were engaged on this exercise one day when we suspected a sniper on a church tower, radioed the convoy accordingly, buzzed this church tower, and the Daily Express picked up the story. I've got the cutting somewhere in there again now. I believe this cleric threw himself off the tower, thinking we were going to fly into him or something, rather, and was killed. So RAF jet swoop on church belfry was the headline, I think, in the Express soon after that. That's my abiding memory of that particular detachment. I left the detachment somewhat suddenly.
Before we actually finish on it, you were talking about your trepidation in approaching Malta.
Mm.
I mean, what navies did you have? Did you have Takan in those days?
No, I don't think we did. We may have had a DME. Essentially, it was two 10-channel VHF boxes. Mm. So one was dependent upon dead reckoning navigation, and when coming within reach of a ground station with direction finding facilities, calling up for a steer. That was somewhat infradig. So one used to call for a true bearing, which is essentially the same thing in reverse, as long as you remember to apply it the right way. And you could call for a true bearing and redeem some pride by asserting you were just confirming your own navigation.
So you just work out the reciprocal and steering.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
And of course, if you've got cross bearings, you could get a fix. But of course, like everything else, it was fear of the unknown. Having done it once, it was a piece of doddle, wasn't it? And of course, our next move, which was non-stop from Malta to Cyprus, on paper presented the same sort of problem, but by then we had confidence. And of course, also, there is usually a high-level cloud formation sitting above Cyprus, which you could see from 100 miles or so out, and you knew you were getting to you were in the right area, at least, where you wanted to be.
So you're detached. You came home after when the panic subsided.
Yes, because perhaps now we are going to move into the V-Force era, because I mentioned to you Duncan Sands' axe had been wielded, and the options for re-employing those who were to leave the squadron were considered. I had volunteered for the V-Force. I was called for interview at Mildenhall, 3 Group headquarters, and one saw no less a man than the AOC himself. And we were interviewed for our suitability to move into the V-Force. I believe the minimum requirement at that stage for those being considered was a high-level average flying ability. And so I was called down to Mildenhall. I was seen by the AOC. He asked me some questions. I believe it was Bing Cross. He asked some questions. I'm a little confused in my mind. I had to go and see him again for a permanent commissioning interview. Perhaps I better leave this for the moment. Suffice to say, he saw that I was a volunteer for the reasons I've already mentioned to you. He said, we like volunteers in the V-Force. We tend to put our volunteers on the Victor. 3 Group then operated the Victor and the Valiant, One group in the north operated the Vulcans. So the Vulcan then wasn't an option. It was the Valiant or the Victor. You'll go to the Victor, he said. I said, well, just one thing, sir. I said, the squadron is on notice to go to Cyprus for this detachment. I would very much like to complete that detachment, if I might. He said, that'll be fine. We'll defer your recruitment to the V-Force until the squadron returns. Well, I'm afraid it didn't work out quite like that. I got to Cyprus and served with the squadron in Cyprus for a few weeks, only to be recalled to the UK to join number 39 Valiant Corps at Gaydon. And so I knew I was going down that route, but not the Valiant route. So, if you'd be interested to hear a little bit about the next stage, I presented myself at Gaydon for Valiant conversion training. I think there were four crews on the course. The introduction to the Valiant course, for me, was a flight on a Canberra to be introduced to some of the systems, the instrument approach aids that we would be using, which were then built into the Valiant, ILS in particular. And I flew one, if not two, sorties on the Canberra to be introduced to the instrument landing system. Ground school followed, where we learned a wealth of unnecessary detail. I say that with some feeling because I had an opportunity later in life to influence the sort of structure of syllabi, because we actually did spend far too much time learning detail which we could do, which was of no interest to us at all. For instance, I remember vividly being required to draw a carbon pile regulator. A carbon pile regulator was the device in the bowels of the aircraft somewhere which regulated the output of the generator to ensure that the charge going into the batteries wasn't excessive. Well, it was pointless knowing how a carbon pile regulator worked. It either worked as advertised or it didn't, and if it didn't, you could do nothing at all about it. I just mentioned that as one example. There was a Valiant simulator. And then I think the co-pilots, who were not teamed up with crew members, flew just two sorties. And that was my experience. I went through as an individual co-pilot, not as part of a constituted crew, because it was intended that I would fill a void that had been created on a squadron in Norfolk. So I completed my Valiant conversion unit in the early months, February of 1959, and I went to Marham to join number 214 squadron, then commanded by Wing Commander Michael Beetham, who of course went on to become Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Sir Michael Beetham, and Chief of Air Staff. I flew as Michael's co-pilot initially, and I do recall the squadron at that stage consisted of eight crews, one of which was commanded by the CO. Five were commanded by squadron leaders and only two by flight lieutenants. It was really a very high-powered unit at that stage, because most of those who had been selected had World War II experience or experience immediately following that on perhaps the Lancaster, the Lincoln. Some were recruited from the Canberra force. So they were seasoned and experienced people, which I found very valuable, because one could feed off this experience if one had a mind to do so. And I hope it could be said now, I took advantage of that opportunity.
When you say you fed off that experience, I mean, if you had old Lancaster hands in Valiance, I mean, they were feeding off their own experience, weren't they? I mean, it was such a quantum leap.
That is absolutely true, and perhaps, again, a story won't go amiss here. I say I was privileged to fly as co-pilot to Michael Beetham. The then CO of Wittering was Group Captain Len Trent, VC. Wittering didn't have a simulator of its own, so Wittering crews used to come down to Marham or perhaps go to Gaydon. But Group Captain Trent came down to do a simulator detail, and he didn't have a co-pilot of his own, of course, so I was tasked to fly with him in the right-hand seat, and that I did. And then began the series of exercises, emergency procedures and the like. I'll never forget the instructor throwing us a practice engine fire. So the red light blinked up here in front of our eyes. Len Trent's instinctive call was, "Feather number three!" He was clearly in a mindset of the piston engine era. Yes, they were indeed learning along at the same time. Mm. The Canberra people, of course, had a better start. But there we are.
So 214 was a fully operational squadron, presumably?
Very much so. Yeah. It was primarily then involved in high-level nuclear bombing. It was equipped with the first generation UK nuclear weapon called Blue Danube, a hefty beast which virtually filled the whole of the bomb bay.
The free-falling bomb.
Very much so, yes. With a flat nose, I remember.
A megaton, or what sort of yield?
I wouldn't want to discuss throughout this interview anything about the yields. I'm prepared to talk about the names of the weapons and the generations, but the question of the yields must remain
still protected.
Yes. I say that with some feeling because I went on to have some responsibility for the policy attaching to nuclear weapons. So its mainstream role was high-level nuclear bombing, but 214 at that time was primarily involved in a series of trials of flight refueling techniques and rendezvous techniques. And this was utterly fascinating. The main trial was numbered 306, and that was simply... that's the wrong word. It was involved principally with perfecting the approach and the making the contact, the speed of approach, and then taking on the fuel and handling the aircraft in this process. There are a number of sub-trials attached to 306. 306A was concerned with using the Rebecca Eureka airborne equipment to perfect the rendezvous. 306B was a fishpool trial, and that involved a modification to the old H2S equipment in the nose, radar nose, to raise the dish so that it could sweep level and look for the aircraft you might want to rendezvous with, the tanker. 306C was the trial of a new probe, the Mark 8, which had a rounded end as opposed to the flat end of the basic probe. And so it went on. Trial 322 was involved with the Javelin, but I'm jumping ahead of myself now. Suffice to say, all crews joining the squadron were required to be converted on to the in-flight refueling role. It was called in-flight refueling in those days. It's changed since. Initially as members of a competent tanker crew. So one had to learn the techniques of trailing the hose, maintaining the balance of the hose, monitoring the contact, monitoring the rate of fuel flow, and so forth.
These are Valiant tankers, really.
Valiant tanker, yes, we were doing mutual work. Each Valiant on the squadron had the capability of being a tanker. In other words, its internal plumbing had been adapted such that the fuel could be used either to could be consumed by its own engines, or it could be funneled out to the hose drum unit, which was mounted in the bomb bay, from which a 90-foot hose trailed, culminating in a conical drogue.
So that hose setup was still carried at the same time as the weapon?
No, it was not. If we were required to revert to the main role, the HDU, the hose drum unit, would be removed and the weapon inserted. And that role changed. Oh, was a matter of hours. And also, of course, on the nose of the aircraft was mounted a long probe, some 7 or 8 feet long, with the actual probe coupling on the end. So we converted onto the tanker role at first, and then, having mastered that, we were allowed to reverse positions and attempt the receiver role. And that was where the excitement really came in. The tanking role was somewhat dull. It required very, very steady flying, because you can imagine trailing a 90-foot hose, if your aircraft was unstable, these instabilities snaked down the hose such that the drogue was really flapping in the air. Of course, if you were flying in turbulent conditions, then, of course, there was nothing much you could do about this.
What sort of height would this be done at?
34,000 feet was the usual maximum, simply because at 34,000 feet, the receiver aircraft didn't have sufficient reserves of power to control the rate at which it was able to overtake the tanker, because initially the receiver had to have an overtaking speed to overcome the turbulence and the drag set up by the drogue and the tanker aircraft. And so as the probe came in towards contact with the drogue and made contact, the receiver then could have throttled back, but it was governed by limitations of power. The tanker would be flying at something like 220, 230 knots at that height. And as I say, the receiver was required to have an overtaking speed about 5 knots or so for sensible contact, for a secure contact. If it came in much faster, it risked making what was called a hard contact, where it would literally push the drogue away, which would then start to coil back onto the hose drum unit. Or less than 5, it made what was called a soft contact, where you might partially open the valve mechanisms and you'd be drenched with fuel. And that happened on more than one occasion with somewhat dramatic results.
Have you experienced later on in taking on fuel from American tankers with a boom?
Yes, I've done that once, to digress.
System,
we think not, because we've never converted to it.
Your personal feelings on this?
No, I'm still an advocate of the probe and drogue, as is the American Tactical Air Command, which uses it. It's only Strategic Air Command that did not go across. They, in fact, attempted to do it to some extent. Dare I say, they bastardized their flying boom apparatus by attaching a very short length of hose with a drogue to it. To give them compatibility with their own tactical aircraft. But I think it was a question, not wishing to give offence to anybody who might have been involved with the policy issues, of not invented here. Sir Alan Cobham's books and Colin Crabbis's book on the history of flight refueling cover this extremely well. We did make a lot of effort, we did invest a lot of time and effort in trying to persuade the Americans to standardise across the board on probe and drogue. There were converts. But I say, sadly, we didn't convert the Strategic Air Command. My experience, you asked for, I had the privilege of flying an F-15 Eagle fighter bomber later when we were refueled by a boom. There were certain advantages in that the fighter pilot just literally sat there whilst the boom operator steered the boom down and into the receptacle. But, well, there we are.
Anyhow, back to the valley.
Yes. Well, that work went on for best part of my 2 3/4 years with the squadron. As the trials proved the concept, we were required to put it to the test by a series of non-stop flights around and across the world. We started off by going south into Nigeria, Kano. Then using Kano itself as a tanker base, and we pushed down through to southern Africa. The three the three landing bases being Johannesburg, Salisbury, and Cape Town itself. When we ran out of any southerly destinations, we pushed across the Atlantic to the Pacific seaboard. But the one that sticks most closely in my mind was the first ever non-stop flight to Singapore. Which I flew with a crew captained by John Garston, who is still alive, living in Kent. We took off from Marham at about 5 o'clock one evening, intending to take on fuel at three locations, Cyprus, Karachi, and then down in the Indian Ocean, where the tankers were based at Gan. And we successfully completed that. The landing at Changi in Singapore some 15 and a half hours later. And those three refuelings were successful. The Cyprus refueling was at night, because we were going against the sun, of course. The Karachi refueling was at dawn, and the Gan refueling was in the day. And we landed at Singapore at about 5 o'clock again, tea time, their time, given the difference in clock time of 7.5 hours, I think it was.
Did you fly manually all the way? Did you have autopilots?
We use autopilots, yes. We didn't use the autopilots at all for the refueling phase of the exercise. We weren't allowed to use them for the tanking phase either. No, the receiver operation was very much a hands-on, a manual operation, but the routing, when just cruising, was very much a... We had the capability of using the autopilot, and one did on a flight of such duration. Yes. That flight concluded successfully in May of 1960. For the return flight, we had to reposition to Butterworth in Malaysia, because the runway at Changi wasn't long enough to allow the Valiant to do a full load takeoff, even at 7 o'clock in the morning. So we flew up to Butterworth, took off from there with a full fuel load. An interesting aside, just before we took off, the High Commissioner in Penang came across with a bunch of orchids, which he said would be taken off us as we got to when we got to the UK, the intention being that they would then be taken down to London and would feature as a table centrepiece for dinner for the Malaysian High Commissioner that evening. And that happened, in fact. But we took off from Butterworth and effectively retraced the same route, refueling Gan, Karachi, Cyprus, and then back to Marham, where we arrived at about 5 o'clock that same day, of course, but this time we were flying with the sun. And that was my most memorable long-distance flight.
Now, this long-distance training, presumably, I mean, the ultimate object of it is to overfly Russia.
I imagine that was in the minds of the policymakers of the day. I was never taken into confidence, given my humble position and rank at that stage. I think I was promoted flight lieutenant in the course of that tour. But yes, clearly that would have been the aim.
I mean, were you briefed on targets?
I will say, perhaps I can say more about that when I move on to the next phase of my career, because I have to say I have no close recollection of that element of our training, because whilst I say our primary role would indeed have been high-level nuclear bombing in the event of hostilities, we were virtually 90% of the time involved in the flight refueling work. And in the course of that work, we converted 90 Squadron to the same tanker role, where I think Freddie Hazlewood was the CO at the time. But I really think that's about all I can sensibly contribute to my introduction to the V-Force, that is, the Valiant. Captaincy would normally have followed on the same aircraft type. So I might normally have expected, if I made the grade in all respects, to have moved into the left-hand seat on the Valiant, staying within three group. But at that stage, the Vulcan force was expanding more rapidly in one group. Also, an element of the Vulcan force was to get more deeply involved in flight refueling training. By this stage, one Vulcan had already flown non-stop to Australia. We, in fact, acted as its tankers along the route. The gentleman who went on to become Air Chief Marshal, Sir Mike Beavis, flew the first Vulcan non-stop to Australia. He was then flight commander, I believe, on 617 Squadron at Scampton. And I was a tanker at Gan for that operation. But the Vulcan force was increasing. It was to get more deeply involved in flight refueling. And so it was decided that with my experience of V-Force operations and of flight refueling, I should change horses. And so I was posted to number one group, again having been interviewed by no less a man than the AOC of the day, who was then Air Vice Marshal Iron Jack Davis. And then I joined a Vulcan OCU at Finningley. I picked up the elements of a crew. We went through the complete OCU course, and I duly arrived on number 101 Squadron at Waddington in the February or so of 1962. And I remained with that squadron for the best part of 4 years. Now,
let's stop the tape at this point, because